First of all, I'd like to have a moment of silence for those unfortunates who perished due to the recent tragedy here in Las Vegas. We each have a moment of silence. Thank you. Dean, would you lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance, please?
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which stands one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Please be seated. And Dan Hamilton, would you like to say a few words?
Good morning. Welcome. Welcome to being here. I'd like to do the UNLV Boys School of Law. We are honored to have the Supreme Court of Nevada sitting here today at the law school for the first time en banc with the full panel of the Supreme Court. So we had to find more chairs, but we did. I very much want to thank Chief Justice Cherry and the Justices, Justice Hardesty, Justice Pickering, Justice Stiglitz, Justice Gibbons, Justice Douglas, and Justice Perrier. I'm particularly honored and grateful that the Supreme Court is here today under the circumstances facing our city and our country. We are strongest as a community, and our community has come together, and it has come together here today with the state's highest court here at the state's law school. And we're grateful. The justices of the Supreme Court have been strong supporters of Boyd. Five of our 2017 graduates are appointed to the Supreme Court right now, some of whom are here today, and five from our class of 2018, several of whom are here today, will be clerking for them next year. The Supreme Court has been instrumental working with our law review on the development of our annual white paper on timely issues facing the legal system of Nevada, including educational school accounts, criminal justice reform, and this year, medical marijuana. This morning we have the wonderful opportunity to hear oral argument at the highest level. The court will be hearing two criminal cases originating in the 8th Judicial District Court and an appeal on the distribution of recreational marijuana. The court has graciously agreed to take questions at the close of oral argument, so I encourage our students and community members to take advantage of this opportunity to learn more about the appellate process and the workings of the Supreme Court. So thank you again to Chief Justice Cherry and the Justices of the Nevada Supreme Court. Well,
thank you, Dean. Before we commence with the first argument, I want to introduce the folks who have put this all together for us. First of all, the clerk of the court, Elizabeth Brown, Esquire. Elizabeth, if you raise your hand, show who you are. We have Dana Richards, our court reporter. Dana, you can't go anyplace without IT. We have Brian Pettyjohn, our IT technician. He's way in the back there, just in case. From UNLV, Nakia Jackson-Hale, the Executive Director of Alumni Relations and Special Events. She does put this all together for us. Nakia, you did a great job. Thank you so much. From the 8th District Court, we have our security folks. We have Officer Porter, Officer Scherer, and Sergeant Wells. From UNLV, we have Detective Velez and Detective Lundquist, and our own Supreme Court Marshal, Ed Schumacher. Could we have a round of applause for those folks who've made this possible? And now let's get down to business. Our first case is case number 72226, State versus District Court. We have Lisa Lucich from the Clark County District Attorney's Office and Robert Draskovich representing the real party in interest, who is a person named Donald Brown. Ms. Lucich, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, thank you.
Each side has 15 minutes. Ms. Lucich, do you want to reserve any time?
I would like to reserve 3 minutes, if I may, Mr. Chief Justice.
It's always a trick to see if they really can reserve 3 minutes with the questions that we ask. Ms. Lucich, go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, Justices. My name is Lisa Lucich. I represent the petitioner here, the state of Nevada, which is a rather unique position for me to be in. In the lower court, the district court acted without authority by ordering a forced psychological evaluation of Samantha in this case. Over the course of years, this court has handled many cases involving forced psychological examinations. The state's position has always been and continues to be that the court really does not have the authority to do that in its entirety. However, as far as this case goes, all of those cases pertain to sexual abuse of children. This case has nothing to do with sexual abuse of a child. This case only involves physical abuse of a child. The primary consideration this court talked about over the years in Court Kirshner was whether there was a compelling need to justify an intrusive psychological examination, is whether or not there is corroboration beyond the testimony of the victim. This court has talked in all of its cases about the fact that in cases involving sexual abuse of a child, most of the cases pertain only to testimony of the victim herself.
But shouldn't there be a balancing policy when you're dealing with somebody who may face a prison sentence? Shouldn't we balance what the advantages are, I should say, to protect the rights of someone accused of a crime versus the right of the child?
You absolutely, Mr. Chief Justice, have to protect the rights of the individual who's accused of the crime, but you also have an obligation to protect the rights of the child. A child has a hard enough time coming forth and describing what has occurred to her over either the course of moments or the course of years. She then has to come to the police, she has to disclose to an attorney, she has to disclose in court, she has to keep disclosing these things. There has to be a time in which her rights kick in and she shouldn't have to undergo a forced psychological evaluation on behalf of the defendant.
How old is the child we're dealing with here?
She's going to be 18 any time now, which is another issue. When the court originally talked about the fact that a psychological evaluation of a child is a thing that should be done, it's because there was a small child who could be very cute and very compelling and very sympathetic with nothing else, and then the defendant has no physical evidence, because rarely in sexual abuse of children cases is there physical evidence. There's almost never witnesses or anything like that. So the defendant is at, in the court's opinion, a disadvantage because he has to overcome this cute small child. In this particular case, she's not a cute small child anymore. She's almost an adult, which further indicates that a psychological evaluation of her is absolutely unnecessary.
Counsel, is Abbott even good law after NRS 50.700?
I would suggest to the court that Abbott is not good law after 50.700. Technically, I guess that would be another issue for another day, because 50.700 pertains only to forced psychological examinations and sexual abuse cases. So in this particular case, 50.700 isn't on point. But I think that the legislature has demonstrated that the rights of the child should be taken into consideration more than it ever has before. And in fact, this court has talked about the fact that when a legislature does speak, that what they say is valid law, and this court shouldn't overcome it just because they don't agree with it. So I would suggest that no, Abbott is not still good law in light of 50.700.
Ms. Lissisha, assuming you feel Abbott's not good law, we have two other cases, Romano and Kirshner. We have a three-pronged test. Could you discuss what you feel is applicable and why?
I think under 50.700, none of that is applicable anymore unless and until the state elects to utilize the services of a psychological expert. Because once the state elects to do that, then the rest of 50.700 kicks in, and then there will be the balancing test whether or not all of those other prongs have been met, and then the court can and maybe should or should not order a psychological evaluation of the child. But under 50
points... She's no longer a child at all. According to my notes, the birthday was July 6, 1998. So that being the case, I mean, she is outside the pale here. So this is an adult in an abuse case, not a sex abuse case. So what law applies to it?
With all due respect, I would say no law applies to it. There is absolutely no law that authorizes a forced psychological evaluation of Samantha. And I apologize, Justice Fairkind. I did the math wrong. I thought she was going to turn 18. I didn't realize that she had already turned 18.
There have been questions posed about the merits of this issue, but I wonder if the court should even entertain the writ, following along with Justice Pickering's point. She's 18 or an adult, but more importantly, in the state's answer to Brown's motion in the district court, you conceded the application of Abbott. And generally speaking, the district court, when not given an opportunity to address arguments you're raising in the writ, shouldn't be considered by this court. Now, generally speaking, that rule applies in the context of a direct appeal. This is a writ proceeding. Why should we entertain this writ at all, given your concession in the district court?
I don't know why they would have conceded that in the district court, but the law is the law, and there is no law that authorizes the district court to enter the order that it did, and that's why we would ask the court to consider the writ.
In spite of the state's concession?
I don't know why the state had conceded that down in the lower court.
Well, they should not have.
I agree. I am the state, and I don't know why they did that.
You're aware of that, aren't you, in the record?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. But as I indicated, the law is the law, and the district court...
Would there be an order... I mean, is this not moot? How can there be a psychological examination of this adult when the law in which the examination was ordered no longer applies because she's achieved majority?
Because there is an order outstanding in the district court that Samantha, not child, that Samantha undergo a psychological evaluation.
The state moved to revise that, given that she's reached the age of majority, and it's not clear to me that Abbott and Romano and Kirshner justify this, no matter how you read them at this point.
The state has not moved to do any of that. The case is sitting in the appellate court right now.
Well, it's on a writ, so jurisdiction remains in district court.
That is definitely something that the state can and should do, file a new motion in the district court to overcome the district court's order.
Has a trial date been set? Or is this case being stayed for this writ?
I apologize. I don't know the answer to that. That being said, we would ask the court to consider this writ still. It is an issue that needs to be addressed, I believe. There are other courts that are considering psychological evaluations in cases where there is no sexual abuse, where there is physical abuse. And the state, the petitioner, the state, would ask the court not to consider expanding Romano, Kirshner, and Abbott to the extent that it might still exist to cases of physical abuse.
Now, let me ask you this. From a policy perspective, what's the difference that you can articulate between the sexual abuse and physical abuse?
The court's concern has always been in the sexual abuse cases that there is rarely corroboration of the child victim. In fact, in the cases where this court has upheld the trial court's decision not to order a psychological evaluation, they have pointed out that there is corroboration.
And you're saying in physical abuse cases, there's generally bruises and there's other corroborating evidence, but when you have somebody redacting rescinding their allegations, generally there's nothing else other than the bruises to corroborate the abuse.
Well, there's bruises that can corroborate the abuse. Sometimes there are witnesses to the abuse. Victims often recant despite the fact that there's a witness that sees it happen. There are also experts that will not only look at the bruises, but can say that this bruise didn't happen the way her recant described it did, because it couldn't have, based on things like that. So in physical abuse cases, there really is much more evidence outside the statement of the victim, especially in this particular case, because the victim originally did say, no, that didn't happen. But when you look at it, the victim had been, Samantha, through the years, there had been allegations of abuse, and she would not follow through with it. They kept putting her back in the home of the abuser. So it's not out of the realm of possibility. You know, why would she not talk about the fact that Donald Brown, her stepfather, did it when they kept putting her back there? And every time she went back there, she was abused again. So the fact that she recanted doesn't necessarily mean that she has any kind of mental problem or anything like that. One of the things that the respondent talks about in his briefs, both in the lower court and here, is the fact that they need this examination so that the doctor, the independent psychological evaluator, can talk about the things like the forensic interview was a bad interview, that they kept begging her to change her story. They kept telling her she wasn't telling the truth. You don't need an evaluation, an independent evaluation of the child, to get that evidence on. The defense can still hire an expert, a psychological expert, who can testify in generalities as to why all these things happen and how the interview was bad and things of that nature. That's exactly what the state is doing. The state is not...
You still have your 3 minutes. Go ahead.
Thank you. The state is not calling a psychological expert that evaluated the child that's going to talk about that. We just talk about that as kind of lay witness testimony. Well, of course she's going to recant because she keeps getting put back in the home of the
perpetrator. That's another question I have for why we should entertain this writ. You haven't been able to identify the trial date. I'm assuming that it's a ways off. There's still time for the state to change its decision with respect to whether it wants to designate an expert. Under Kirshner, at least, that would be a prerequisite under Factor 1. So why should we entertain a writ that engages in an issue about an individual who's now 18, addresses an issue that you conceded in the district court, but more importantly, now has an issue where there's more time for the state to make a decision where Kirshner may be applicable? Shouldn't we let this play out in the district court and see where this goes from here? I recognize there's currently an order, but a lot has changed since the order was entered.
That is correct, and if the court decides not to entertain the writ, obviously the state will respect that decision, and then the state can go back and file something in the district court asking the court to rescind the order based on those
issues. Before
you
leave us, I do have a question on Kirshner, and that has to do with, in Kirshner we talked about a benefit to the state from a psychological expert. What about the number of instances in which the state calls investigative detectives, others, who are asked to express opinions about the veracity of a victim's testimony or lack thereof? Is that a benefit that triggers Kirshner?
I am not aware of any situations in my 15 years with the Special Victims Unit where any of us have actually asked the detective to comment on the veracity. We know and recognize that it is the jury's field to determine the credibility of all of the witnesses, that no individual can comment on the veracity of a witness. So I'm not aware of any situation where we actually did that. And we also know, since Kirshner, Abbott, and those cases, that if we go over the line and ask questions that kind of make our witnesses an expert, that we're opening ourselves to the possibility of a forced sexual psychological examination. So I haven't seen it happen. I hope it hasn't.
Has the state committed in district court to not calling any kind of psychological expert?
Yes. Yes, we are not. I see my time is up. I would ask the court to consider the writ and to order the trial court to revoke its order granting the forced examination of Samantha, and I would thank the court.
Thank you, Ms. Lucas. Now, this is a learning process for all these students that are here. Now, Ms. Lucich, a skilled DA, wanted to save 3 minutes, but because myself and my colleagues asked a bunch of questions, I, as Solomon, have to decide, should I give her the 3 minutes and then give Mr. Draskovich an extra 3 minutes? And since we're here at the university and feeling very humbled to be here at UNLV Boyd Law School, Ms. Lucich, I'm going to give you the 3 minutes. Mr. Draskovich, I'm going to give you an extra 3 minutes, which means you have 18 minutes, but that doesn't mean you have to use the 18 minutes.
I don't like to hear myself speak.
Yeah. I'm just trying to be even-handed as the Chief Justice. Mr. Draskovich, you have 18 minutes. Ms. Lucich, you'll have 3 minutes in rebuttal.
Chief Justice Cherry, Honorable Justices of the Nevada Supreme Court, there is no trial date pending. This is a matter that should be litigated in the district court. The alleged victim has reached the age of majority. This should be a case that should be decided by a jury.
Mr. Draskovich, why should we be putting the alleged victim on trial? That's what you're in essence doing by wanting to.
And you know, that's a very good question. But we're really not wanting to put her on trial.
Then what are you doing?
We're wanting to bring in the light of science in the courtroom. We don't expect juries to just determine issues of reliability or veracity on the alleged victim's manner on the stand. We should bring in science.
What can you gain that you could not gain as it presently sits, where you can show the inconsistent statements? You already have that in your arsenal, so to speak.
We do. We have an alleged victim who was interviewed repeatedly by CPS from 2008 through the early part of 2014. She often recanted and changed her story as to what occurred. She was removed from the home in January of 2014. In September 16th, she appeared at the hospital and allegedly suffered a self-induced concussion. On September 28th of 2014, she again appeared in the hospital and suffered a golf ball-sized contusion in her vaginal area that was, and again, allegedly self-inflicted. Our position from the get-go in this case is she may be suffering from a psychological illness that should be diagnosed.
So do the medical records, or if you've seen the medical records, or do you have any inclination that the medical records would show that? Because you're talking psychologically, you're not talking from the medical aspect.
And that's a very good point, Justice. And sometimes there's a parity of the two. We do have physical findings, just like the physical findings that she'd suffered from 2008 and 2014. And it's been our position that there may be a psychological basis for these physical injuries, because each one of the injuries that she had suffered from 2008 to 2014 was allegedly self-imposed. There had been multiple, at least 7 CPS and ultimately DFS investigations concerning her physical injuries. There had been never any sort of a psychological evaluation of what was occurring. I've heard through the state's argument that there's these, we're asking for a forced psychological examination. We're not. We're asking for an independent evaluation.
Well, who's that? Please.
It would be independent if she's volunteering. Is she volunteering to do the examination? Is she volunteering?
She has not had that opportunity. As soon as Judge Smith ordered this independent
Is the defendant's asking for this examination?
We are.
It's a yes. Okay, thank you.
And both the defense and the state were asked to provide 3 names for an independent psychological evaluation, for a name of an independent psychological evaluation to occur, and the proceeding was stayed, and hence we're here before you.
There's a question that bothered me at the end because this went down to the district court made a finding. It got reversed, sent back for the proper findings to be made, and the district court entered a second order. And there's a question whether or not the district court's present order is appropriate pursuant to the law now, that they made their finding using the wrong standards. What's your opinion as to that?
As Ms. Lucich has pointed out, we're kind of in gray area, in a position of flux. We're not dealing with a minor here, and we're not dealing with an allegation of sexual abuse. We're dealing with an allegation of physical abuse.
But do you agree Romano doesn't apply in this case, nor Abbott?
Based upon the findings in those two cases, no.
Should it then just I understand the position Justice Hardesty took earlier, should it go back to have a new finding based upon the current circumstance since she is no longer a minor?
I would agree with that finding, Justice Douglas.
So you agreed to vacate the order?
We would. In all candor of the court, absolutely.
What authority have to back up the request? We have a statute on point that's very specific, deals with sex assault, victims and witnesses, very narrowly lists particular offenses that it would apply for. You're asking to expand way beyond what the legislature knows how to say, what's never been held in case law. What is your support for that, except that you want to bolster an attack on the credibility of a victim?
And Justice Siglich, there's an inherent right to due process that a defendant has that's accused of crime. And that right should not be stripped of him or her if he's accused or she's accused of physical abuse versus sexual abuse.
But sir, either way, they haven't put the mental state of this person in issue. And just by testifying, yeah, they put their truth and veracity. You laid out here quite eloquently how you'd attack it through the traditional means, cross-examination. So the fact that you're asking for a psychological exam to see if somebody's a truth teller.
Not necessarily truth. And you see, we have to make a separation between credibility and reliability, and that's what I would submit that science should actually weigh in on. We're not here to attack the credibility or the veracity of anybody.
Is there science that you can point to that can tell us whether or not somebody is reliable or not? Because then we should have them in every courtroom. Why don't we have every victim and every witness subject to a psychological exam for reliability?
There is a fairly reliable area of scientific study concerning allegations of false abuse, whether it be sexual or physical.
Have those been allowed to be introduced in district courts thus far?
I've had a handful of them. Usually it's an uphill battle. So.
Well, I was going to have experts.
Yes.
But an expert can testify in that fashion without subjecting a victim or a witness to an invasive procedure, so to speak.
And that is true. And just to distinguish, oftentimes when we bring in what's called a blind expert to talk about the studies that are out there, it's always brought up by the state, well, you didn't have an opportunity to interview this alleged witness, you know, victim. You didn't speak to her. Therefore, your testimony should not be taken into account in the determination of guilt or innocence or not guilt on the part of the defendant. So it's, like I said, this is an area of the law that's
I think in a situation flux. Like that, that would be a dangerous line to cross and a dangerous argument to make because it seems a little contrary.
In this case, we have a person who has allegedly suffered abuse at the hands of the defendant. There's been repeated recantations. There's been various stories given as to the cause of the abuse or the cause of the injuries. We're asking for once to have her interviewed by an independent forensic psychologist. And, you know, psychology is the study of human behavior. Forensic psychology is taking well-established principles and applying them to certain circumstances. It's not a defense expert that we're asking this person to be subjected to. We're just hoping to actually try and find out maybe what the root cause of these injuries are and not to assume the defendant caused them.
Draskovitz, it's kind of an interesting issue here. What do we do in the context of independent psychological exams for that would be or might be applicable to a juvenile who matriculates? I don't know. I haven't seen any cases on that issue, so maybe this is appropriate to have the district court and you all litigate that. This probably isn't the first case in America where a child became an adult between the incident that occurred and the trial. And so why not consider the same applicable issues, if they were appropriate, as in Kirshner, for example, to that circumstance? Seems like a very interesting legal question that really hasn't been developed very well. But apart from that point, my question has to do with, now that she is an adult, why can't you retain experts? There's a lot in this record about the various statements made by the victim that are contradictory. Why can't you, as you mentioned in your brief about Grasso, why can't you bring in a witness that talks about the potential grooming of this witness and the impact on the reliability of her statements, as you would if this case involved a young adult?
And, you know, just as hard to see, we can. I mean, it was the state that had filed this extraordinary writ. Mm-hmm. I felt that it would, should be within the purview of trying to be effective assistance counsel to ask for an independent psychological evaluation. Sure. We do have experts that we can bring in to testify absent having interviewed her. But nonetheless, this is something that I think we should actually develop better at the district court.
Well, is there any thought of medical experts in this case, since it's an abuse case, a physical abuse of defense, bringing them, asking for a medical examination? Your own medical, your own doctor?
You know, there's no question that physical, there were physical injuries, but it becomes the causal connection between what caused these physical injuries that really become at issue. I mean, the two worst injuries that this alleged victim suffered through the course of 7 years was while she was in foster care, which, you know, obviously brings to question, is there a psychological issue, like a Munchausen syndrome, is there something else that's going on that could explain this chain of injuries that have been occurring from the early to early 2008 through September of 2014.
She also, though, had black eyes, cuts, finger marks, and a broken tooth.
She did.
So not insignificant injuries.
No, and I'm in no way trying to mitigate that at all.
And even if we were to adopt your suggestion here, how would you get over the hurdle of the ample corroboration that is here? Why is this even a close call in terms of corroboration? The siblings indicated that the child was abused and abuse occurred in the home. There are physical injuries that correspond to that. The defendant has a history of child abuse. Why aren't all those things corroborative, even if we were to adopt your position?
Mr. Brown has a 1984 conviction.
Right. For corporal punishment and voluntary manslaughter of his own daughter.
The corroboration from the siblings didn't come about until they were removed from the home, were placed in foster care, and were subjected to multiple interviews.
So should they, going along with your thing, then should they be subject to psychological examination to make sure that their testimony is reliable as well?
That's a good question. That brings to question an entire number of different issues. I mean, I think a blind expert can come in and talk about the issues of suggestibility of children, of taint. In this case, we're just dealing with Ms. Lawrence.
You've got 5 minutes left. Go ahead.
Obviously, right now, I would prefer to focus on the alleged victim in this case and her physical injuries.
But we're not just making rules here for her. We're making rules for everybody. So that's fine to say you want to focus on her, but you're asking us to adopt a rule, expand the rule of law here, make case law that's going to apply to everybody. So I'm thinking about all the cases that we'll get after this.
And our position would be that there's a good faith basis to bring in the question of corroboration and the reliability of an alleged victim's testimony, that we should be able to bring in an expert to conduct an independent psychological evaluation. I mean, in the reality of these cases, a kid makes an allegation, CPS gets involved, Metro gets involved, the child gets separated from the family. They are subject to repeated interviews, sometimes extremely coercive in nature. They ultimately see a doctor, and then the state basically has the monopoly of access to the complaining witnesses, and we're just asking the defense have an opportunity to examine the basis of these allegations.
Any further questions? Anything else you want to add, Mr. Jensen?
I'll submit it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your argument. Ms. Lucich, you have 3 minutes, and while you're approaching the podium, my question to you is, since the idea of being a DA is to find justice in a matter, why would you not want to have an independent psychological evaluation of your victim, just maybe to dispose of the case? If it's favorable to you, maybe you work a plea. If it's unfavorable, maybe you'd consider a dismissal. Maybe I watch too much Law and Order. I don't know what Jack McCoy would do in this situation, but what would Lisa Lucich do if, in fact, it's a favorable evaluation versus an unfavorable evaluation?
The way I look at it, Mr. Chief Justice, is I have spent my entire career representing the victims. I speak to them. They cry to me. They cry with me. I can never, ever say that it's a good thing to force them to undergo any kind of evaluation. What you're telling them is nobody believes you, and therefore you need to be evaluated by this person that because the defendant, the person who abused you, wants you to be. The perpetrators often are successful in their abuse for so long because they convince the victims that nobody's going to believe you if you tell. And if you tell, you're only going to get in trouble. So by forcing them to undergo a psychological evaluation, you're reinforcing what the perpetrator said to them. Nobody believes you, and you're in trouble. That's why I would never want to ask one of my victims to undergo a psychological evaluation.
Ms. Lucich, though, isn't this a search for the truth, supposedly?
It's absolutely a search for the truth, but just because somebody is forced to undergo a psychological evaluation doesn't mean that the sky's going to open, the birds are going to start singing, and the truth is going to fall from the sky.
But if we don't ask, we don't know if the truth might fall from the skies. Above and beyond that, Mr. Draskovich made a concession as to the prior order, having it remanded back. What is your feeling about having it remanded back if we accept his concession? And if so, should an IME even be considered?
Once he said, we agree to rescinding the order, I was pretty much done. I don't want her to have to be evaluated. But the problem is that if he just rescinds the order, then we start relitigating whether she should be evaluated under an other theory. So the petitioner, the state, is asking this court to say, no, you can't evaluate her, district court, because there is no law that supports it, and therefore she should not be evaluated, and that's what the state would ask the court to do. Unless,
any further questions? Thank you, Ms. Lucich.
Thank you all for your time.
This matter will stand.